Good evening, everybody. I hope you are all doing okay and bearing our challenging weather right now. But as long as we're all safe, I'm hopeful that the power won't go out. The wind is blowing quite heavily right now here in Baltimore. So if I freeze or I disappear, it's nothing you said. Don't worry. Okay. So last week, last Shabbos, we read Parshas Kitisa. Parshat Kitisa, I think one of the most fascinating parshios in the Torah. There are literally I don't know how many topics to choose from, but there are some pivotal moments. People make the assumption, I shouldn't, it's not fair, but they make the assumption. Most of us know that the giving of the Torah, the Ten Commandments that God spoke to all the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, was a few weeks ago in Parshat Yitro, right? In Parshas Yisro. Most people assume that right around there is the famous expression that when God offered the Jewish people the Torah, they responded, Na'aseh v'nishma. We will listen, we will do, and we will listen. Right? That was the crowning expression that they used. And God was so pleased with that, that we were willing to accept it without asking. So tell me what's in it. Jews have made up for that ever since. Because if you ever go to a store and you want to know something, you say, well, tell me a little bit more about this. And why are you charging like this? I think we should haggle and negotiate a little bit more. So for history, we're making up for that one lapse of judgment. Where we, no, I'm kidding, right? Of where we went ahead and we said, Na'aseh v'nishma. But folks, that was not in Parshas Yisro. It really was not. It's actually quoted in last week's Parsha in Kitisa. So there's a recap of that story. And then you fast forward and you have the tragic incident of the golden calf. That takes place in last week's parsha. Now, as an interesting, it doesn't always work out this way, but often we had a second Torah reading last Shabbos. I mentioned in a few weeks ago that in this time period, from the beginning of Adar, a couple of weeks before Purim, until the Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the month in which Passover falls, we read four special Torah portions in addition to the weekly portion. If you recall early on, the first one we read that was special was known as Parshat Shkalim, the giving of the half shekel. We read about that because they would announce at the beginning of the month of Adar that it's time to collect the annual donations for the communal projects, for the communal offerings. Everybody had to chip in a half a shekel. And then the Shabbos before Purim, we read Parshat Zachar. Remember what it is that Amalek did to us. And why do we do that? Because we know that Haman was a descendant of Amalek. And so we read the story of the Jewish victory over Amalek. So we read the story, the original Amalek attack right before Purim. Last Shabbos, we read Parshat Parah. Story of the red heifer. Everybody know what the red heifer was? The red heifer was literally a young cow, and it had to be completely red. The hair had to be red. And there was a whole ceremony of they took it, they slaughtered it, they burned it, and they took the ashes and mixed it with water, and they would sprinkle it on anyone that had become tameh, anyone that had become ritually impure, defiled, by coming in contact with the deceased, right? So we read that. So it's interesting. Rashi asks a very simple question. Why is it that there's this ceremony of the red heifer to cleanse from the story of somebody who became impure? Why? Why would that be the ceremony? So Rashi says a phenomenal thing. Listen to this, Rashi. It's worth listening to the words of Rashi here.
Hi, Robin.
Hi, Roland.
Where is it here? One second.
Hi, Robin. How you
Yes,
been?
I'm on row. I'm good. Everybody
All
say hi.
right, all right. We can catch up
I'm
on
good.
social stuff later.
Sorry.
Hold on here. Here we go. I'm not finding the exact words, but Rashi tells us, again from the early sources, the golden calf, how old was, like, when I use the word calf as opposed to the red cow, the red heifer, what which is an older, which is younger?
Calf is younger.
The calf is younger. So Rashi quotes from an early source and gives the analogy of a young child who's still in diapers, who soils himself and causes a real big mess. Who comes and cleans that up?
Parents.
A parent. Yes.
Ben.
Yes, you're pointing, Marty. I noticed. Don't think I didn't see that. But actually, Rashi does say that only because, not because in a chauvinistic way, but the mother who cares the most about their child says, "I put aside my stinky, smelly child." No, the mother says, "This is still my wonderful child, and I will come and clean him up." Says Rashi, this red cow is coming to atone to clean up the mess of the young calf that was the golden calf. So I find it always very interesting that often the Shabbos we read, Parshat Kitisa, which is about the sin of the golden calf, is also the Parsha, the Shabbos that we read often about the Parah Aduma, the red cow that's coming to atone for that. It's very interesting coming at the same time. So there's so much to be said. I'll throw one more thing at you of the topic we are not going to talk about. Who sinned with the golden calf? Which demographic within the Jewish nation sinned with the golden calf?
It was the people who left Egypt, the rebel rousers that left Egypt.
Didn't we all leave Egypt?
No, the ones that were not, I don't think it was the Jewish
Was
people,
it
it was
a
the people
Moab?
that came.
Wasn't it Korach?
All but the Levites.
No, the people that
All but the
came
who?
from Egypt.
What'd you say, Jeff? All but the whom?
All but the Levites.
The Levites. Okay. You sure? Is that your final answer?
All but the men.
Oh, all but the men?
All the
It was
men,
Edward
all
P.
the men, all the
Robinson.
men, all the
All the
men.
men. So you're saying the ladies didn't do it?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
Except for the tribe of Levi,
oh,
yeah.
okay. So the right answer is all the men. The men were the ones who sinned. The ladies did not partake of this. Good for you, ladies. You know what's right. You have an intuitive understanding of right and wrong. Most of us men are, yes, thick. We take many, many, many tries to get it right. However, Jeff is also right in that there was a segment of the male population that stayed away, and that was the tribe of Levi. They also did not participate. But let me ask you, the Torah tells us and gives us a census of how many Jews left Egypt. And the Torah gives a general number, about 600,000. 600,000 men between the ages 20 and 60. Let's even go on a conservative level. Let's assume each man had one wife, and I'll just, for argument's sake, two children. Hard to believe, right? But let's even just go with that. So there's 600,000 males. Correspondingly, you should have 600,000 ladies, right? Their spouse. Plus, that's 1.2 million, plus another 1.2 million children, because each family had two kids at least. So you're talking about upwards of 2.5 million people. And that's not including the people over 60. That's a lot of people. And the many of them served this idol, served the golden calf. And God, we know, is very upset. He even gets to the point of where he tells Moshe he's so angry he's ready to wipe out the Jewish people and start again with Moshe, right? How many people would you have anticipated dying from this event where God is so angry and a plague runs through? How many people would you have expected to die in this plague, to die in this incident? Give me a ballpark figure. Don't think too much. Come on. Just give me a
About
number.
half,
How
about half,
many?
About half of the total.
About half the total. You would expect a 500,000, because there's 600,000 men, take out Shevet Levi, okay, and at least 500,000, maybe more, right? How many people actually died?
Not that many.
That's correct. Not that many. It should come to
3,000.
you as a shock.
80.
How many?
80.
I think none,
Oh, that's a little low.
none.
3,000.
3,000. 3,000. Now, I'm not poo-pooing 3,000 people dying. That's a lot of people. But in context of who sinned with this, how did only 3,000 die? And why? Which 3,000? So there's where we get to Robin's. Robin was saying it, but I don't think she understood all of what she was saying. She's a good poker player. She's going to throw it out there and she'll like, okay, let's see if this sticks. We'll try. Good. So you are correct. There was a segment of Egyptians. Egyptians, while the Jews were still in Egypt, as the plagues are pounding the Egyptians, there was a group of Egyptians that saw the writing on the wall and said, yeah, I think we need to change sides. I think the real survivors here is not going to be Egypt. It's going to be the Jewish people. And they, quote unquote, converted. They, quote unquote, decided, yeah, we'll go along with it. But their level of commitment was not complete. In fact, God himself, at some point later, after the sin of the golden calf, actually points a finger to Moshe and says, these are your people. What do you mean these are my people? Moshe says. He says, yeah, these are the people that you were willing to accept. You didn't ask me my opinion. Not so fast. Who are those people? So you use the word rebel rousers. I think
Yes,
Fred used that word.
I said
Oh, you say Robin, right?
it.
Rebel rousers. In Hebrew, it's called the Erev Rav. It was the mixed multitude. It was this group. And you know how many there were?
3,000.
3,000. Now, what was different about this group than the rest of the Jewish people? You have to read the words carefully. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce you to this book. It's fascinating read. Read it carefully. It's so good. When they revel around or getting ready to dance around this calf, there's a group of them that turn to the Jewish people and they say, Eile Elohecha Yisrael. This is your God, Israel. This is your God, O Israel. Think about that expression. This is your God? What grammatically should it have said? This
Our
is
God.
Our
our
God.
God. What do you mean this is your God? Ela, these, Elohecha, your God, Israel. The sages don't miss a beat and they pick up on it and it said that's how we know that that was that group. That group that came along were not really committed. In fact, they didn't even identify themselves as being part of the Jewish people. And when it came time to this pivotal moment, they were all encouraging to say, this is your God. See, this is the big distinction. And maybe one day we should talk about this because it's so important. Where did the Jewish people mess up with the sin of the golden calf? I'll give you two options that maybe you didn't think about, but here are the two options. The calf was there to replace fill in the blank. What was the calf coming to replace? Choice one, God. Choice two, Moshe.
Moses.
God.
Moses.
Oh, okay. You're all so smart now. You all go like this, two. Yeah. But
Moses.
if I had started with that question, I think most of us would say, what are you talking about? God is so upset because the Jewish people were trading in the God that took you out of Egypt, that spoke the Ten Commandments, and now you're going to believe in a calf, in an idol? You know who were those people? That's this Erev Rav. They're the ones who said, this is your God, Israel. The rest of the Jewish people, while they committed a terrible, terrible thing, it was not replacing God. It was replacing Moshe. They were looking in their minds, They felt that they were unworthy to have a direct relationship with God. And this, in their minds, the same way that Moshe was acting as an intermediary, they felt they still needed one. And if Moshe is delayed in coming back, Moshe's not coming back from the mountain as he promised, then we need something else to act as that in-between, that go-between between us and God. This is an important lesson. The Erev Rav were replacing God with the golden calf. And for that, it's a capital punishment. That's idolatry 101. They died for that. The rest of us, we sin terribly because we felt that we could not have a direct relationship with God. And God is like, what are you talking about? That is the most special thing that I have, is my personal direct relationship with you. You don't need any intermediaries. Judaism is based on the premise there is nothing and no one between us and God. And the golden calf was there in their minds as that intermediary to replace Moshe. It's a terrible thing. It's a horrible thing, but it's not trading God. And that's why they were not actually killed. We suffer to this day from it. The fallout is tremendous, but it's not the same level. Just something to think about. Okay. But what I want to talk about tonight is at the very end of the parsha, and people skip it all the time. Let me refresh your memories. A few weeks ago, we had Parshat Truma. And in that parsha, in Parshat Truma, it talked about all of the different vessels that were in the tabernacle. It talked about the Mizbeach, the altar. There was a copper one, and there was a golden one, and there was one made of stone that they brought the animals on. There was a menorah that was made of gold. There was a shulchan, the table that housed the showbread. We talked about that the other day. Yes? All the different vessels were talked about in Parshat Truma. Then you had the following week was Parshat Tetzaveh. Tetzaveh was all about the Kohen's vestments, about the special clothing that the Kohen's, when doing the service in the tabernacle, what they would wear. The special hats, and the Kohen Gadol had a special forehead. Right? You see, I would make a very good Kohen Gadol at this point, because it would sit very, very nicely, and there's a lot of room for it to fit. Right? Those of you who have big chooks, right? It's not going to work. So guys like me. I'm becoming more of a fan as time goes on of the t-shirt that said, God only made a certain amount of perfect heads. On the rest, he put hair. So that's more in line with where I'm at. Okay? Okay. And it talks about the special breastplate that the Kohen Gadol wore and the apron and the pants and all that. That's in Parsha Tetzaveh. Then you have Mishpatim. I'm sorry. Then you have Kitisa we had last week. And at the end, the very last paragraphs of Parsha Kitisa, it throws in one more vessel, which was not discussed in Parsha Truma at all. It was the kiar. In English, they call it the laver. What was it? It was a water basin. It was a massive basin that they had water in. For what purpose?
Wash your hands and feet.
Who washed their hands and feet?
The Kohen.
Correct. The Kohanim, before the very first thing they do when they come into the tabernacle and then subsequently in the temple, they had it also. The very first activity they needed to perform was to wash their hands and feet. Remember, they walked around barefoot. Right? If you recall, on the festivals, even here nowadays in the diaspora, we have Birchas Kohanim. We have the priestly blessings. They take their shoes off when they do it. Why? Because it's a throwback to the way the service was done all the time in the temple. The Kohens worked without shoes. Right? You say, what about socks? Another time. We'll save that for the Mishmar class that, you know, when we do the halacha. Okay? But here you have this kiar. What was so special about it? What was it made of? What material?
Copper.
Very good. It was copper. Very unlike most of the other vessels that are in the temple or the tabernacle that were made of gold. Why is this one made of copper? Where'd the copper come from?
The woman's mirrors.
Okay, Sharon, you must have studied this parsha. That's not fair. No, it's great. That means you did your homework.
Yes,
It
it's what.
came from the mirrors. They didn't have in those days, like we have, of a piece of glass and you put a little silver thingy behind it. What they did is they used to take copper, which was very common, and they would rub it to an extent that it shined and you could actually use it as a mirror. The mirrors were donated by the ladies, right? You think the ladies' auxiliary of your synagogue is something new? This goes back more than 3,300 years, folks. The ladies' auxiliary was phenomenal back then, just as it is now. They donated these mirrors to be made into this laver. Moshe, when he heard about this and he heard that the women were all coming to donate their mirrors, Moshe did not want to accept them. He did not. And when asked why, he explained very simply, what's its function? Its function was for the ladies to look at themselves, doll themselves up to look really good so that they can entice their husbands to be with them. That's like you're in the Yetzer Hara's den. You're like, you want me to bring the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination about turning on your spouse and looking really good for this, and you want me to bring that into the temple? I should be making a vessel out of this? Do and Yiddish, du bist mishega? Are you crazy? God intervenes and he says, absolutely, are you wrong? You are wrong, Moshe. You must accept it. It is so dear to me. I want it to be the vessel that is going to be used by every Kohen to start his service. So he does. And that is the kiyar, that's the laver that's used. What is going on here? What exactly are we supposed to take from this? You mean to tell me that the Yetzer Hara, well, let me say it better. I think it's appropriate for us to talk about, take a deeper dive into what is the Yetzer Hara and what's its function. If we had started the class, right? So let's pretend you knew nothing about this kiyar. You knew nothing about the laver and you knew nothing about the mirrors of the ladies. And I said to you, do you think it's appropriate for people to come in wearing, how do I put this nicely? Highly provocative clothing when they came into the temple. Do you think that's appropriate? I think
No.
we can all
No.
agree the answer is no. Because that's not the place for it. You know, what goes on behind closed doors between spouses, that's fine. You know, that's there. That's where it belongs. But to go ahead and to bring, that into the temple, come on. I had a teacher once. I remember this. How long ago was this? I must have been, I'll give myself credit, 19. 19 years old. I think maybe 18, but 19 for sure. I wasn't even 20 yet. And I remember I was sat down, I was learning in Israel at the time. I was in a yeshiva, and I had the privilege of a one-on-one session for about 20, 25 minutes. I'd say most days. The rabbi wasn't always there, but most days. And we studied Mussar. We studied character development. And we had a particular book that we were using. And I remember. It's like it's vivid as can be. He said to me, can you imagine on Yom Kippur night, on Kol Nidre night, when the shul is packed and everybody there knows why they're there, they're dressed in white, they're focused, they know what this very auspicious moment is all about, and they start ready to getting ready to start Kol Nidre, and the first thing we do is we open up the ark, getting ready to take out the Torahs, and they open up the ark, and in his language, he says, Verminishgit, OMG. What do they find there? One of those girly magazines. Right there in the Aron Kodesh is the Playboy. It's sitting there in the Aron Kodesh. I mean, first of all, I'm an 18, 19-year-old kid, and I went, how do you know about that? But I didn't say it. It crossed my mind, right? Fine. But he says to me, you can imagine the shock and the feeling of revulsion. That what? someone would have the chutzpah to put in the holiest place in the synagogue. They would put that filth. And then he paused and he looked at me and he said, I don't know what you struggle with. I don't know. I'm not suggesting you have this problem. But tell me, please, why do people feel it's okay to put it into their own Aron Kodesh? Why are they okay putting that filth into their own ark? There, as a person, as a Jew, as somebody who wants to have a connection with godliness, and you put that. Why is it any worse than putting it in the ark of the synagogue? Why you put it in yourself? It like I remember it like it was yesterday. I asked you, Moshe seems to have a very good argument. The mirrors were used to excite, you know, the sensual pleasures of this world. The ladies were not looking in the mirror to make sure that everything was straight so that they can go to the Midbar market, right? They weren't going to the desert inn. They weren't. It's not that they were doing it for their husbands. Moshe has a good argument. Why should I bring that into here? And God says, no, you're wrong. So it begs the question, what is the Yetzer Hara? What is it? Is it a friend or is it a foe? What is it? Is it something good or is it something bad? What do you think?
Depends how it's used.
Go ahead, explain.
Well, like in the example of the what you're saying, the Yetzer Hara in the marital relationship, because the results, if you're out just with every person that is, I mean, the results are there. It's not in a sanctified, holy atmosphere. So the results, in other words, what I'm saying is what Moshe could have seen or what God is implying, if you don't have a minion, have a congregation, if you don't have a nation, what's good the priesthood? In other words, you have to have. The result was that the nation was created by that means.
Who says it was a good thing?
God, I guess God does.
Okay, that's the question. Let me ask it this way. Is it better to get rid of that Yetzer Hara completely?
Well, in the beginning, in Bereshit, he said be fruitful and multiply. So
okay. But it didn't necessarily have to have, you know, prior to Adam and Eve eating from the tree that they weren't supposed to, reproduction was no different than any other bodily function. It didn't have a sensual or a sexual connotation to it. The same way that you put food in your mouth, you eat it, you ingest it, and it gives nourishment to your body and your soul. So, and your ears are doing the bodily function of listening, and your mouth is doing the bodily function of talking and breathing, and your eyes are doing the bodily function of seeing, then your reproductive organs are doing the bodily function of reproducing. It's not an excitement of getting the Yetzer Hara. Before they ate from it, it wasn't an excitement the way we envision it now. So I'm asking you, if you want to go back to Bereshit, the way it was originally designed, then it wasn't about an excitement of a Yetzer Hara. I'm just playing devil's advocate. But you're right. You are correct. The world needs the Yetzer Hara. You have to have a desire. You know, one of the most fascinating things I remember reading about football players in particular is that they have such, I'll call it high tolerance of pain, but it's really, they're so jacked up that they literally, their body can't determine that they are hurting. And they'll play with a broken arm. They'll play with a broken rib. They'll play because they're not processing it. Do you know why after this class, you're gonna go ahead and you're gonna have a snack? I can guarantee it. I know I will, right? Why are you going to have a snack after this class?
You've expended a lot of energy.
Yeah, I know I will for sure. but
you're hungry.
That means you're going to have, there's going to be a part of you, I'll call it a hunger pang, right? I'm not saying you're famished. You probably had dinner already, right? But there's that little part of you that's like, I could use a little topping off before I go to bed tonight. I don't know, just a little something. I'll call it the hunger pain to just, have something. If you did not have a hunger pain, you would not eat. I know many of us would do it anyway because we're just so conditioned to do it, and that you get up in the morning and you have your breakfast. Are you hungry? I don't know. But you have your breakfast because that's the routine. But if you really were thinking about it, you would actually go ahead and, am I hungry? Yes or no? If the answer is no, then keep moving. I'm convinced there's one particular Rebbe that I had in yeshiva. I am 100% convinced he never, quote unquote, goes to sleep. Oh, he sleeps, but he doesn't do like I do, because I look at the clock and say, it's time I should go to bed. Who determined that that's a time that am I tired or not? If the answer is yes, okay, so then I go to sleep for a few hours until I'm refreshed, and I keep going until I'm tired, and then okay. Why is this the ma I'm not saying we should change our routines here, folks, right? But I'm convinced. Why do I say that? Is because I was living in Columbus and I used to email him questions. First of all, to call him, he wouldn't even start answering questions until midnight because he was busy. That's when students of his from all around the world would call him with questions starting at midnight. Okay. I wasn't always up at 2 o'clock, and I figured, okay, you know what? Before I go to bed, I'll just email him. He was great at email. Okay. And I would get responses within 24 hours, almost always. But it varied. You see, I'm OCD. I have my routine. I have my morning routine, and I have my time in the office that I check my email, and then I put that aside, and then I focus on something I need to work on for a grant or whatever. And I have my routine. Okay, it's harder and harder because I keep hearing the ding of the email coming in. But in theory, I have my spot. He did not. He went ahead and he did his learning, he did his teaching, he did his whatever it is. And when he was tired, he lay down, slept for a couple hours, he got up and kept going until he was tired again. So I can get an email from him at 2 in the afternoon, 2 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, 3 in the, it didn't matter because he wasn't on a schedule. So the Yetzer Hara, I would argue, is both friend and foe. It really is both. Well, let me explain. They tell a story. I'll read you a story. There was a early there was an Israeli author. He's known as Shai Agnon. Shai was an acronym for Shmuel Yosef, Shin Yud. Shmuel Yosef, but he got the nickname Shai. Many of you probably have heard of him. He was a very, very prolific writer. He wrote extensively on different themes and topics around his Jewish identity, his relationship to Torah, his Judaism, the land of Israel. He wrote many, many great stories, a lot of them short stories. Anyway, he penned one of them that was called Me'oyev Le'ohev, From Foe to Friend. That's the name of that little From Foe to Friend. It's a short story. And it describes the struggle, human struggle, to tame nature, to try to establish a home in the land of Israel back then. And all the different winds that kept trying to prevent him from establishing his roots in Israel. The winds weren't only the winds like we're experiencing tonight from weather, but it's also the Arab population, the Israeli government. All the red tape and all the obstacles to go through, the winds that kept pushing him away from what it is to reach his goal, to finally get settled in the land. So he makes a very, whatever, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but somebody reflected on it and said the Yetzer Hara is ultimately our greatest teacher that's concealed in the disguise of an enemy. The Yetzer Hara is our greatest teacher who's concealed in the disguise of our enemy. When you hear that little voice in your head to get you to do something wrong or not to do something right? Simple example. You set your alarm clock because you decided, you know what? The rabbi really inspired me. I'm going to make an effort to say some kind of blessings in the morning. But I know I'm on a very tight schedule. So you know what? I'm going to set my alarm 15 minutes early. 15 minutes earlier, right? Doesn't have to be at 4 in the morning. It's 15 minutes earlier than what you normally do. And the alarm goes off. And man, you're facing your first challenge of the day. Get up or snooze? Get up. It's really the right thing. Come on, Tzvi. You can do this. Oh, I'm so tired. I went to sleep later than I should have. I stayed up to watch one more episode of some stupid mind-numbing sitcom on Netflix, and I'm tired. Huh. Struggle. Okay? When that voice is in your head, what does the Yetzer Hara really want from you? Boil it down. What does the Yetzer Hara want from you? Does he want you to get up or does he want you to hit snooze? What does he want?
Hit snooze.
That's what you think. I think most people would agree with you. But I, Tzvi Tachman, disagree. I disagree. The job, you know, the Yetzer Hara, what kind of creature is it? Is it a human being?
I think so.
No. No. What is it?
Is it a snake? Dave wondered.
So it's from the Garden of Eden. So the snake is the representation of it. That's not the Yetzer Hara is not every snake you see. But what is it?
It was like an idea or a
an idea.
An evil inclination.
Okay, so that's those are nice words we use, but what is it?
I think it's the animalistic part of your soul that wants you to just do what you want, that's struggling, that helps you struggle with the other part of your soul that wants you to do what's right.
Okay. So I'll ask you a question.
Could be an angel.
Okay. So hold that thought for a second, Jeff. That's where I was going to go. In approximately 3 weeks, we are going to be sitting down at the Seder. And for those of us who actually make it to the end, there's a song called Chad Gadya, One Kid. Right? We all know that song.
Yeah.
Chad Gadya, Chad Gadya. We get to the end of the story and it talks about and the kid is hit by he's chased by the cat and the dog and the stick and the fire and the water and the until you get to the ox that drinks up the water and the shochet kills shechsi, slaughters the cow, and who kills the shochet? The angel of death, right? Oh, and then comes the hard one. The angel of death, and then what happens to the angel of death?
Most of us don't make it to the end, you can tell.
Yeah, you can see.
It's such a long song.
Ay, ay, ay. I don't know if I have a Haggadah here. The end of the story is that the angel of death is shechted by God himself. God slaughters the angel of death. And that's the end of that. God is the ultimate end. Okay? The angel of death. Does he have a couple of other names? We also know him by other names. One of them is our topic tonight.
It's Yetzer Hara.
The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. It's the same dude. Your Yetzer Hara is an angel. Now, yes, you are all correct. It's something within you that you struggle to get you to do the right thing or not to do the right. I get that, right? It's something within you. But it is an actual angel whose job and mission it is to present you an alternative to doing what God asks you. For free will to exist, you have to have how many choices? Two viable options. If there was only one option, if there's no Yetzer Hara, and it's just, I hate to use it, axiomatic, you do the right thing. Because what's the alternative?
Okay.
You have to be tempted to not do the right thing. So that little voice in your ear that says, go ahead, you'll get up, you'll start this program tomorrow. Snooze is good. That voice in your head is that little angel trying to get you to consider the alternative to getting up and doing the right thing. Angels. Think of it this way. Let's go back to the famous, who has a big, massive, all-out brawl with an angel?
Jacob.
Jacob. Muriel, I think of you every time I think of that story. I think of you. Yaakov has this battle royale. Who's this angel? Who is he?
Evil inclination.
Oh, the evil inclination. But we also know him as... Whose archangel is it?
Esau.
Oh, Esau. Esau's archangel, right? This is the battle of what? Yaakov representing truth, representing goodness, representing spirit, all the positive things on this side. And on the other side, this is the heavyweight battle of ethics and morality in this world. It's good versus evil. I hate to break it to you. Star Wars was not the first movie that focused on the battle between good and evil. This has been going on since the beginning of time. Yaakov and Esau. Yaakov against this angel. What happens at the end of this story? They struggle and fight all night long. And the morning breaks. And the angel turns to Jacob and says something phenomenal. What does he say to him? Come on, Muriel, this is your department. What does he say?
Who are you?
He says, what? You got to let me go. Why? Because as day is breaking, my time has come to sing praise to God. It's time. I got to go. I got to go back up to heaven. It's my turn to sing praise to God. I'm an angel. Angels praise God. And the commentaries all wonder, what does that mean? You've never had this chance before? Jacob says, I'm not letting you go until you bless me first. Okay, fine. Gives him the blessing and he tells him fine. But what does this mean? What does this mean? In all my years of existence, the angel says, from the day I was created until now, I've never once had the opportunity to sing a praise to God. Finally, my time has come. You got to let me go and offer my praise. Why now? It almost sounds like the kid who the teacher realizes is futzing around and he wants to make sure that the teacher makes sure that the kid's paying attention. He said, so Yankel, can you repeat what I said? And he goes, oh, sorry, can I go to the bathroom? Right? At the precise moment that the teacher wants to go and get the, I got to step out for a moment, sorry. That's what it sounds like. Yaakov says, I want a bracha. And he says, I got to go. Now? Why now? At this precise moment, it's time to sing? Okay, what is the job of an angel? Let me rephrase it. Let me say it better. No, I'll say it that way. What is the job of an angel?
Whatever God tells him to do.
Okay, and when did he become an angel?
Right before this.
Right before
okay.
that.
At that moment that God gave him a job. Let's be clear. None of this stuff in the TV that we grew up with where somebody died and grew wings, it takes time, and again, they become angels. Farfig Nugan. No, an angel is a non-physical creature that God gives a mission to, and its mission is its essence. That is what an angel is. If the angel, it's not like there's a room full of angels and God calls out the next one, like jury duty. Okay, can I get angels 100 through 175? Because, you know, I need somebody. It's not how it works. There's no queue waiting in line. It's when there's a job to be done, God creates and says, okay, this is your essence, this is your job. And when does that angel cease to be? When the job is over. That's it. An angel is just, it is what it is. Nothing more, nothing less. So logically, if the angel's function is to do whatever it's supposed to do, when do you think is the most appropriate time for that angel to sing praise to God? I'll give you three options. The beginning of its mission, in the middle of its mission, or at the end of its mission?
Right at the end. Right at the end, right before he finished.
Right when it's complete, that's my time to go. So now I'm asking you, Jacob and the angel are struggling mightily between right and wrong, good and evil. And the angel, when he realizes that he cannot harm Yaakov any further, he realizes, my gosh, my mission is done. I have now helped, this is the key phrase here, I have now helped Jacob become the complete person to stand for righteousness. Because he struggled with me, he had to step up his game and become even greater. The angel was the mechanism by which Jacob became whole and complete. You follow that? Mm-hmm. Now it makes perfect sense. Now as the dawn is breaking, the angel says, I gotta go. This is my once in my lifetime opportunity. My job was to present an alternative, to be the contrast for you, Yaakov, but for you to overcome me. Now that you were successful, my time has come for me to go up to heaven and give the praise. Because my job of motivating you, getting you to be better than you were, which was my objective in the first place, was fulfilled. Now it's time for me to go up. That story takes on a whole new meaning now. The job of the Yetzer Hara is not just to be the bad guy. That's not really. In its essence, he seems like a foe. He's trying to get you to do sleep in. Forget about the prayer service. They'll be fine. They'll have a minion without you. That we think of that as, oh, he's so bad. He really needs some kind of rehabilitation. Send him to Rabbi D's class. He really could use it. That's what we think the Yetzer, but it's not. The Yetzer Hara is the coach. Now, the coach nowadays, if you try this shtick, you're out. Right? The tough love approach, that doesn't fly. Nowadays, everybody needs kid gloves. And like, oh, you're doing great. Fabulous. Don't worry. You'll do bad. This is fabulous. Right? No, there comes a point of where you say, hey, stop futzing around and get to put your thing into it and let's go. Sometimes you need that. The Yetzer Hara in the morning says to you, hit the snooze. You know what he's really saying? Don't hit the snooze. Beat me at my own game. I want you to get up, but I can't. My job is to present the alternative. My job, my mission as the angel, to present another option. But in my heart of hearts, I want you to beat me. I'm really your friend, but I dress as a foe. Where am I getting this from? You're like, okay, it sounds great, Rabbi, but you're blowing smoke. I'll tell you where it comes from. You say it in the Shema all the time. We say, V'ahavta, and you shall love. V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha, to love Hashem your God. With what? V'chol levavecha, with all your heart. U'v'chol nafshecha, with all your soul. U'v'chol me'odecha, with all your might. How do you say heart in Hebrew? I'll be more specific. How do you say your heart?
Levcha.
Say it again.
Levcha.
Okay, it's probably libcha if you want to print it right. But how would you spell it? Lamed.
Lamed vav.
No, bet or vet.
Vet. And the cha.
And the final cha. Three letters. Lamed bet cha. Libcha. Mm-hmm. But that's not what it says. It says bechol levavcha. It has two vases. Lamed vet vet chaf. So we have two options. The printer screwed up, right? Or if you read it in the Torah, it actually does have both of them, and you ask the better question of why. To say your heart is one singular heart is lamed bet chaf. That's how you say it. Libecha or libecha. Bechol libecha, with all your heart. The same way you say bechol nafshecha, with your soul. So libecha, lev is heart. Libecha is your heart. But it doesn't say that. It uses two bets, levavecha. And the Talmud asks this. This is not my question. The Talmud asks, what's up with the spelling? And the Talmud says, because you have two inclinations in your heart. You have a Yetzer Tov, a positive inclination, and a Yetzer Hara, and an evil inclination. Okay, very cute answer, but what is it? What's being said? You are to love Hashem, your God, with all of your hearts. Whoa. Love Hashem with your hearts? If you have two hearts, you better go see somebody.
But with the evil inclination and the
good. So that's what Marsha's going to suggest, exactly what the Talmud says, is that you are to serve God and love him, express that love with both your Yetzer HaTov, your positive, your good inclination, and your Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination. So the good inclination, that's easy. I understand how I serve God and I love God with that good inclination. The one that says, get up in the morning, start the day off right, say Moda Ani, wash your hands, say Shema. That I understand. But how do I serve God and show my love to him by my Yetzer Hara? With my evil inclination? How do you do that?
By fighting it and doing the right thing.
So now you know the answer. Now you know the answer. When you go ahead and you struggle to overcome the Yetzer Hara, the one that is really, and does an excellent job, I must say, the Yetzer Hara is, if I had to choose a player on my team, I would choose him in a heartbeat. He's so convincing. Man, really good at his job. But we are to serve Hashem with that heart too. The one that says, fight me. Come on. You can overcome. I know the temptation is so great. I'm making it that way. But only because I know you can overcome it. And that's ultimately what I want you to do. So as I said before, the definition of the Yetzer Hara is a friend who's disguised as a foe, but he's really your friend. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that you become buddy-buddy with the Yetzer Hara. That's not my suggestion. I'm not suggesting you be like, hey, you know what? I'm going to listen to you all the time. Your advice is excellent. I'm going to sleep in late. I ain't ever going to shul. I am not giving tzedakah. This is what I hear. Yetzer Hara, you the man. Don't do that. But know and understand that that's his function. His function is to tempt you, not that you fall prey to it, but just the opposite. So that you rise above it. You overcome him. Just as Yaakov overcame that angel, we get to do that every day. That's our job. So now we go back to the story. Moshe is faced with a dilemma. He sees the women wanting to present the copper mirrors. And he's like, whoa, I don't know about that. That's got Yetzer Hara written all over it. And Hashem says, no, you don't understand. Why did the women dress themselves up? It wasn't because they were just looking out for themselves to make themselves look beautiful. They did it so that they can be with their husbands to keep the Jewish faith going, to have children. The men came home after being beaten all day by the Egyptians. Yeah, I know it sounds crazy, but even they weren't interested. And the women, yeah, they had to incite, they had to inspire that. They did it with the right intentions. They used the Yetzer Hara. They used it for a positive usage, so that there be the next generation of the Jewish children, the next generation of the Jewish people. This is how it works. People use this idea in so many ways. But once you understand this concept, that the Yetzer Hara, while yes, it's not the person you want to be, the angel that you want to be chum-chummy with, because you got to be on guard. He's so good at it, and he gets us to do things or not do things when we really should or shouldn't. but understand that the underlying purpose of it is to give us that chance to overcome him so that ultimately we are serving God both with the positive inclination, the one that encourages us explicitly to do the right thing, but even the challenge that the Yetzirah presents to us for us to overcome, that also is in the service of God. And that's why when the Kohanim came into the temple first thing in the morning, that's the first thing they did, is they washed their hands and feet in preparation for serving God, both with the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. You can harness that power of the Yetzer Hara. Friend or foe? Yes. That's my answer. What do you think? It's a whole different way of understanding it. Questions? Gotta be questions. I mean, this is like new territory. Okay, if not, fabulous. Okay. I gave you what to think about. You have a week to come back with all of your rebuttals and all of your questions.
Okay, Rabbi.
I think everybody is still stunned. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'll jump in and ask a question. Okay. Say, the Itzarah is there. We fail. So then when we come back again, there's going to be another chance for us to try to make it right or overcome again. So that second time that we come in, the challenge is going to be twice as hard as it was the first
time.
That's
true. That is very true. But that's no different than any other growth that we have in life. When you fail, yeah, you have to pick yourself up and try again. And yeah, but it may be more challenging. But Monroe, you're also twice as smart now. You also know that, you know what, if I really want to get up those 15 minutes earlier, then I'm not going to stay up that extra Netflix episode. I'm going to be better about it, because for me to get up in the morning, I got to be able to go to bed at night at a decent hour. Okay, so now, burned once. What, how's it go?
Fool me once, fool me twice.
Whatever it is, you learn from your mistakes. Okay, so now the Yetzirah is going to try a different tactic, but okay. And basically, we talked about this, the idea of your free will point is always moving. Because today, you won, you got up on time, so you moved the needle a little bit in your direction, and you've conquered more ground, right? And then tomorrow, you got to stand your ground, because if you give in, then you're conceding a little bit, and it keeps moving. The goal is to keep moving over time, that it's going in that direction. It's going to go like this, but ultimately, you incrementally keep going up and up and up. Yeah, so you always have to be on guard, no question. But understand that the reason why God gave us this Yetzirah in the first place is that's our coach playing tough love with us and saying, I need you to overcome this. I have one last picture. I have this great, I don't know what movie it was from, but I saw a clip of one of these big guys who play the line in football. And he was ready to give up, and he just, I can't do it. So the coach basically blindfolded him and put a little scrawny, running back on his back or something. And he said, I want you to crawl with your knees and up. Right? I want you to go 20 yards. That's it. Just 20 yards. That's the one. Once burned, twice shy. Right. That's something like that. Very good. So he puts the guy in the shoulders, but he's blindfolded. And the coach is there literally in his face screaming, come on, you can do this. Go another. Come on. One more step. Come on. Come on. I can't. My legs are burning. Come on. You're almost there. You're almost there. And he kept pushing him and pushing him and pushing him. And finally, the guy's like, I have to be there already. He goes, no, you still got two more. You got to keep going. Go, go. And finally, he conks out. He said, I can't go any further. And he falls to the ground. And the coach takes off the blindfold. And he had done the entire 100-yard football field. It's an amazing clip. The Yetzirah is screaming, don't give in. I know it sounds good. I know it sounds good. I know your legs are burning. I know you want the sleep. Don't do it. In his heart, he's saying, don't, come on. The Yetzirah wants you to succeed by overcoming him. Don't give him the pain of listening to him.
Yeah. Anyway. Like everyone, Rabbi, everyone here, I love how you teach.
Thank you.
And so we have lots of snacks tonight, right? For thought.
Rabbi, wasn't it burnt one, shame on you, burnt twice, shame on me?
Something like that. I don't remember the phrase anymore, what it is I was looking for. But when you've done it once, right, you now know what to be on guard for and don't let it happen again. Okay, yeah. Now we're a little smarter. That's the example. If you know it's hard to get up in the morning, force yourself to go into bed 15 minutes earlier. Okay. I know it sounds great, but that's what we got to do. People think before the high holidays, okay, I just got to get ready for Rosh Hashanah. Do you know why there's a month called Elul that precedes it? It's so smart. It's because our natural tendencies is to wait to the last minute, and sometime ere of Rosh Hashanah, we go, oh, Farfignugin, tomorrow's Rosh Hashanah. I don't even know where my Rosh Hashanah machzor is. Yeah. So God gives us an entire month of Elul that says, hey, Rosh Hashanah is coming. Let's start doing so. Let's start preparing. Oh, I don't know. Yes. The same thing every day. We have to be prepared. The Yetzirah is coming out us full force. Each one of us, it's what's unique to us, where we're struggling. Your struggle is not mine, and mine is not yours. Every one of us has our own personal Yetzirah. For some, it's in the whatever. We all know. I don't have to explain. Go ahead, Robin.
When I was studying this Torah portion last week, and I do not remember because I did not come up with this, but I read somewhere, and it applies here also. It's one line. You need to learn to fail, or you will fail to learn.
There you go. There you
I just
go.
Love it. It's very easy to remember and just turn
there
it
you
around.
Go.
Fishing.
That's a great point. So that's our Yetzirah. He's a foe, but he's really a good friend. All right. Have a great rest of the week. Stay safe. And God willing, we'll see you next Wednesday.
Hey.